I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
New elections have been announced in Denmark. The current and likely future prime minister says her government wants to be a good partner to the U.S.
You can rely on us. You can trust us. We will do whatever we can.
Except give up Greenland. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, how President Trump's moves on Greenland bolstered Denmark's ruling party. Also, Israel wants the personal data of aid group workers in Gaza.
Israel is saying, well, if you don't give it to us, you can leave.
And 4 years into Russia's war in Ukraine, some Ukrainians are stunned by what they have gotten used to, like living most of the day without power.
Every 4 hours off, and only 2 hours it's on.
Those stories, plus a Brazilian indigenous art movement goes global, and U.S. foreign assistance gets more transactional. That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thank you for coming along this Thursday. We begin today in Denmark, where Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen announced in Parliament that the country will hold snap elections in March.
Kære danskere. Jeg har i dag indstillet til Hans Majestæt Kongen, at der udskrives valg.
It means her party will need public support to stay in power.
It is a calculated risk, but Frederiksen goes into the vote with a new wave of support, stemming in large part to the popular response in Denmark to how she confronted aggression around Greenland from Washington. The World's Josh Coe told me about that when he spoke to us from Denmark earlier today.
First of all, I think it's important to understand that when Donald Trump was saying the U.S. should take over Greenland, take control of Greenland, that really resonated here in Denmark, and it resonated with a lot of concern. You know, Greenland is the semi-autonomous territory of the Kingdom of Denmark. And when you see, you know, this powerful ally like the U.S. saying, hey, we'd like to take a piece of your territory, people here were upset. People here are still upset. And her government, Mette Frederiksen's government, has really been very diplomatic but firm on pushing back against the Trump administration on this, as we heard at the Munich Security Conference earlier this month.
We will try to see if we can find a solution, and you can rely on us. You can trust us. We will do whatever we can. But of course, there are red lines that will not be crushed. We will stick to our strategy.
This very careful but firm approach is precisely what a lot of analysts are saying is the reason why we're seeing support for her jump from about 18 to 23%. I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot, but you have to understand, like, Denmark has over 12 parties, and having that big a chunk makes you one of the big players. Her party, the Social Democrats, have not been doing too well lately, and this is what they're calling the Greenland bounce. So she's taking advantage of that bounce to call these elections.
Yeah, so Prime Minister Frederiksen flexing. Briefly, Josh, what is she known for?
She is really known for being tough and almost, you know, to the point of uncompromising, but somebody who can lead in a crisis. You know, she came into office in 2019, and then suddenly there was COVID. She had this big scandal in 2020 where she ordered roughly 17 million minks on mink farms to be culled. This slaughter of these minks, she was saying, was necessary because of the fact that they could spread COVID. There was a lot of concern because she didn't get parliamentary approval for that. And so that was kind of seen as this big, like, overreach of government. But some said, you know, this was necessary. And she didn't really know that that was something that she needed to request. But she's been in the driver's seat through Russia's invasion in Ukraine and really stepped up to the plate, really trying to bolster Denmark's military. We've had a lot of hybrid warfare concerns here, you know, drones circling airports, military bases. And she's kind of had this firm approach of, we will get through this, but this is a serious moment. I spoke to political scientist Jakob Dreyer, and he said one of the major changes she's made, especially in her party, the Social Democrats, has been that she's taken them from the left to the right on immigration.
So she's willing to talk about criminal immigrants and saying that we gotta ensure that the amount of migrants, refugees coming to Denmark has to come down. But although it's seen as tough for some and also too tough a line, it's actually seen as one of the reasons why she's been able to keep and maintain power in Denmark for the last years, because the Danish general opinion, at least the majority's opinion on migration, is quite tough.
So, Josh, what stands out to you about today's announcement from Denmark's prime minister about snap elections?
I think especially that she went out, credited her colleagues in this speech. Troels Lund Poulsen, he's her defense minister, and Lars Løkke Rasmussen, her foreign minister.
Det er et samarbejde, der har været ordentligt. Det har været respektfuldt. Det har været præget af godt humør.
She's characterized her work with them as having a lot of respect, you know, good humor, and choosing what serves Denmark best.
And why does that stand out for you?
Well, they might be in her coalition, but they're also partisan political rivals. I mean, Poulsen is from the Liberals, which is actually a party on the right. And then Rasmussen, her foreign minister, is from the Moderates, which is sort of like a centrist right party. So he also lost to Frederiksen in 2019 as the incumbent. And so to me, that's pretty striking after watching something like the State of the Union earlier this week. The political scientist Dreyer says that this is sort of a dream team of rivals. And it's kind of unprecedented in Denmark. Not in the past 40 years have you seen something like that. But it really showed its value during this Greenland crisis with the US.
So if you look at the Danish public, they believe that the combination of Mette Frederiksen and Lars Løkke Rasmussen, the prime minister and the foreign minister, has really been a bit of a dream team where Lars Løkke has been the cunning fox and she's been sort of the strong leader with clear statements. And that sort of put together has enabled Denmark to manage that crisis pretty well. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why both the Social Democrats and the Moderates really see an increase in support from voters.
And at the same time, because of that, you're going to see these two rival parties, the Social Democrats and the Moderates, doing really well in this election at the same time.
Yeah, so what's the outlook for this election?
Well, Dreyer says this one is really more of a toss-up, more than ever. I mean, you usually see like a left-of-center coalition or a right-of-center coalition. Here, we don't know yet, but Lars Løkke Rasmussen, he might run, he might try to run as prime minister. We do know that her defense minister, Troels Poulsen, is running against her. But he said the most likely situation is that we'll see Mette Frederiksen as the prime minister again.
Josh Koh is a producer with The World based in Denmark. Josh, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you, Marco.
The United States has said it will wind down health aid to Zimbabwe. That's after negotiations around a funding agreement worth more than $360 million collapsed. Money provided to the African nation's government through this bilateral agreement would have replaced some of the aid that used to flow through USAID. That agency was shuttered last year. The Zimbabwean government rejected the deal partly due to requirements around sharing health data. And several other African nations are reviewing their new aid agreements with the U.S. as well. Stephen Morrison from the Center for Strategic and International Studies explained that when we spoke today, starting with what it is about these agreements that a growing number of African nations are objecting to.
Apparently, there are conditions included in these agreements that call for sharing of data and sharing of specimens, as well as reportedly other transactional agreements, which may be with respect to access to critical minerals and the like. And it's touching on issues of sovereignty.
I do want to drill in to the Zimbabwe case, just so we can look at this as an example. The Zimbabwean government took issue with specific conditions about data sharing in the agreement, according to, you know, statements from a government representative, and also sharing of specimens of pathogens. Can you tell me any more about that and what Zimbabwe's concerns were there?
Well, on data, it's privacy. And the pattern has been to rely heavily upon international NGO implementers that have controlled the data and have controlled the standardization and collection of data. That era is ending, and responsibility for standardizing and ensuring quality and collection and protection of data is shifting to the partner countries. And that's one of the big open questions is, are we going to enter a period where there is less standardization and more uncertainty about quality and protection of data?
So, for example, if all the data about how viruses are spreading right now does not go through the WHO, but is held by specific countries like the U.S. when they give money to a specific country, what are the implications
of that? Some of the data we're talking about is surveillance systems. The sharing of pathogenic samples is with respect to you have an outbreak, you need to investigate the genetic makeup and quickly move towards the kinds of tests, the diagnostics, the therapies, and vaccines required to bring those under control. But the sovereign concerns of a country like Zimbabwe is, well, what guarantee is there to have affordable access to those tools? And these are valid and legitimate concerns, and they stem from the terrible experience that African states had during COVID,
right,
which brought forward very dramatically that low-income countries, African and others, or middle-income countries, in the case of South Africa or Zimbabwe, were at the back of the queue.
When it came to vaccines.
With respect to vaccines and other critical inputs, and they paid a huge price for that.
What is at stake on the ground for people who previously did benefit from U.S. aid dollars helping provide care for things like HIV treatment, et cetera? What's at stake for people in Zimbabwe?
Well, so the Zimbabwe government, in taking a strong stand of this kind, if it results in a permanent rupture, it has grave consequences for its own population. It would be a tragedy. Neither Zimbabwe nor the United States can afford to have this rupture happen and be permanent.
This is being seen as a more transactional approach to providing health aid. Is there a precedent for the U.S. using health aid money as leverage in other types of deals?
This has not been the pattern. This is a new dimension of having conditionalities that apply to other sectors, you know, whether this is tied to critical minerals.
As in the case of Zambia, we're learning.
Yes. You know, this is a transactional doctrine. I mean, if you read the America First Global Health Strategy, this is an administration that has laid this out.
I do want to ask about historical precedents, though, because I've been reading that the Biden administration did sign bilateral deals with some 50 countries, including some in Africa as part of this deal in biosecurity. So they got pathogens in return for this aid.
Yeah.
So is this substantially different than things the U.S. has done in the past?
Well, the agreements concluded under the Biden administration were part of its global health security strategy, and that was not a transactional strategy. It was one that was calling for sharing of data, but it was investing in capabilities in health security.
So this seems different on balance to you.
When we say transactional here, I'm assuming, and again, it's difficult to know exactly because we don't have the exact terms of what's in these agreements that are now being scrutinized.
Right. So there's limitations to what we can know. We've talked about, you know, how the criticisms or the concerns that Zimbabwe, for example, have here are valid about, you know, sharing data and pathogen samples. But you also mentioned how some of the goals of this new strategy from the Trump administration aim to improve basically self-sufficiency and governments building up their own capacities. Could there be upsides to this approach?
Certainly. I mean, the reform measures that are at the heart of this strategy are ones that have been applauded by African governments who looked at this acute dependency upon the United States and thought, this is dangerous. So I think we should be hopeful that there can be progress and that this model can work.
That was Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies discussing the crumbling aid deals between the U.S. and Zimbabwe, plus other African countries.
In Japan, a 7-month-old monkey, a macaque at the Ichikawa Zoo, has gone viral. Punch is the monkey's name. It was rejected by his mother and by the other monkeys in the enclosure. So zookeepers gave him a stuffed orangutan for consolation. Punch has bonded with the toy, and pictures of the lonely monkey cuddling with his comforting companion have warmed hearts around the world.
Some people who saw those images were surprised, but it turns out this all bears out what proponents of attachment theory have long said. This toy is essentially an attachment figure, and it's filling a very real animal need.
Ahead, all eyes are on Iran as the international community tries to tamp down escalating brinksmanship with the U.S. Plus, with all the uncertainty, Iranians living in Turkey seek out places to connect with one another and relax. Those stories are coming up here with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Talks today in Geneva could be the last chance for the U.S. and Iran to avoid war. Representatives from both countries are attending a third round of high-level, high-stakes talks mediated by Oman. Esmail Bayi is spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry. During a break in the talks, he said through an interpreter that public remarks from U.S. officials ahead of the meetings have created confusion.
We need to continue. We need to wait and see. This is a process, and there have been contradictory comments that are being made by a number of American officials. So still, it casts a shadow of doubt over the whole process.
The Trump administration wants Iran to stop enriching uranium, which is a key step toward building a nuclear bomb. That has created a palpable tension at the talks. Iran has been adamant for years that they are entitled to produce nuclear power and do research, and that they are not working toward a bomb. Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, reiterated Tehran's stance that building nuclear weapons would go against statements made by the supreme leader.
Unlike a typical political statement, which some may view as rhetoric, a declaration by a religious leader carries moral and binding authority. Acting otherwise would be neither permissible in practice nor acceptable in principle.
The U.S. is also demanding that Iran curtail or stop its production of long-range missiles. Iran has said that is a non-starter, and it's not backing down on that despite threats of an attack by President Trump. Iran has issued some threats of its own. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned that Iran could sink American warships and hit all bases, facilities, and assets of the hostile force in the region.
Meanwhile, next door to the Islamic Republic, Turkey has become a haven for Iranians who have left their country. And many Iranian-owned businesses have popped up over the past few years, especially cultural spaces like cafes and bookstores. The owners of these shops and their customers say Turkey is a place where they can live with more freedom than they would have on Iranian soil. From Istanbul, reporter Fariba Nawa has that story.
The live singer at Shanti's restaurant has a full house for an audience. She engages the crowd with popular Persian songs. Families eat their rice and kebabs. A toddler sleeps in a stroller. Young men and women drag on water pipes, smoke snaking through the low-lit venue. Grandmas nurse their cocktails. Women in glittery short dresses with a stylish little boy dance to the beat. If you're Iranian, this is where you let your hair down and drown your sorrows for a night. I ask one woman to talk outside the restaurant. It's too loud to speak inside. Sitara Taibi is a psychologist and beautician from Tehran. The 34-year-old ended up living in Turkey and faced a lot of obstacles as a foreigner here. Taibi says she comes to this restaurant with her friends to be happy and dance. When I miss my family in Iran, even though it doesn't solve everything, I feel a little better when I come here, Taibi says. Shandi's has been in business for 6 years, and that's remarkable because Turkey's economy has been suffering from inflation. But the economic prospects here are still better than in Iran. In fact, it was economic hardship that spurred the recent uprising there. You can see more Iranian businesses opening branches in Istanbul. The Turkish Chamber of Commerce and Industry reported that the highest number of companies founded by Turks in 2025 were with Iranian partners. It's easier to go into business with a Turkish citizen than to start one as a foreigner. Mohammad Zerati, owner of Shandiz, says inflation of the Turkish lira is hurting his restaurant. But it's not stopping people from coming. And not just Iranians. Even Turks and Arabs enjoy the cuisine. These spaces have increased in the last few years because of the demand for Iranian culture, food, and music in a family-friendly gathering, Zerati says. I ask him if the demand is also about women's freedom. Women can't sing and dance legally in public in Iran. He says it is. They can do those things here, and God willing, Iran will change too, he says. Shandi's cut out its entertainment program temporarily for a few weeks after the Islamic Republic killed thousands of protesters in Iran in January. The restaurant management wanted to show their respect for the victims. But Iranians in Turkey say they need the joy that these types of venues bring more than ever. They want to connect with other Iranians in the opposition who want to see music and dance as a form of resistance to the regime's hardline stance.
It's like an act of rebellion.
This woman's an English teacher from Tehran. She didn't want to give her name because she'll return to Iran and fears persecution. The teacher plans to go to Shandiz to dance soon. But she's been getting that connection at a place called Cheshma. It's an Iranian cafe and bookstore that holds literary events for Farsi speakers. The English teacher says she looks forward to these events. They give her a sense of unity in a time of tragedy.
I think the collectiveness of the experience is what helps people maybe like reduce the emotional pain, because when you interact with people of other countries, they don't really understand and it actually becomes more painful.
Cheshma is a branch of the printing press in Iran that publishes books and novels. The manager, Hossein Chiraghi, says they find their customers on social media. One of Cheshma's goals is to publish Farsi language books into Turkish and English. But Chiraghi says most customers come for the camaraderie. Every weekend, a group of Persian literature lovers gather to read the Shahnameh, the 11th century epic poem titled The Book of Kings. Nushit Mirzayi is a Shahnameh expert. She explains how the story of Rapunzel may have its roots from one of the tales in the epic about a princess named Rudabe. The princess Rudabe unties her hair and drops it from the tower for her love named Zal to climb, Mirzayi says. The group takes turns reading the literary Farsi, which can be challenging, like Elizabethan English. During a break, Negar Yegana heads outside for a smoke. Yegana is a 33-year-old homemaker who has lived in Istanbul for 7 years. She comes here to feed her nostalgia for Iran. I'm happy this place exists, Yegana says. She tosses her long, silky black hair and takes a puff of her cigarette in the crispy winter night. I was telling my friends that when I come here, I feel like I'm walking on Tehran streets. I grab a couple of books, hear the Farsi language, and talk about issues that I'm interested in, she says. After the January killings in Iran, the mood has shifted at Cheshma. It's a bit more somber, patrons say. But being together has made the grief more tolerable. Among the attendees at Cheshma are poets and writers. One of them is a playwright who wrote a script invoking the voices of demonstrators killed last month. One recent evening, each person in the group read a verse from the script. Some cried. And then they all held hands and sang the Iranian national anthem predating the Islamic Republic. For the world, Fariba Nawa, Istanbul.
Aid groups in Gaza are coming up against new demands from Israel. More on that is just ahead. This is The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Starting Sunday, dozens of aid groups will be forced to halt operations in Gaza and the West Bank. That is, unless they agree to hand over detailed personal information about their staff and funding to authorities in Israel. High-profile NGOs like Doctors Without Borders and Oxfam face expulsion. Oxfam's Bushra Khalidi in Ramallah was blunt about the consequences.
If we're forced to cease our operations, food distributions are going to stop, shelter pipelines are going to stall, and support to clinics treating, malnourished children will be disrupted. That's not abstract. That's actual families that are already surviving on one meal a day, losing even that.
Some of these aid groups have come up with a way to challenge the new Israeli rules. This week, they told Israeli courts the demands go against European privacy laws. Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem has been following the story closely.
They're seeking kind of intimate personal data, names, ID numbers, bank account numbers, all sorts of affiliations, any organization you've ever been affiliated to. And the Israeli claim is that they need this to make sure that there are no terror-linked employees of these groups. But of course, what these humanitarian organizations say in return is that there has been all too much evidence during this war that Israel is targeting humanitarian workers and that they can't risk the lives of their own employees. And they mean it doubly, not just because Israel is targeting them, but because in some cases, Hamas would accuse them of collaborating with the enemy if these details were turned over.
So how exactly are aid workers arguing that European Union privacy laws apply to operations in Gaza?
Look, it's a strange argument, and I'm not sure that they will succeed. It's strange on several levels. For one, mostly we're talking about Palestinian employees, and they work in Palestinian territories, right, in the West Bank or in Gaza. So these organizations claiming some sort of immunity from Israeli law because they're European and that European law prevents them from doing such and such thing, I'm not sure that will prevail.
So the aim of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU, in case we forgot, is to give individuals control over their personal data. And it applies to any organization worldwide that targets or collects data from EU residents. So does that suggest that these aid organizations are based in the EU or are using their headquarters in the EU to establish that residency requirement?
Many are based in the EU. But I would be surprised if we hear in a few days that the Israeli courts recognize the standing of a European court to handle something that is taking place in an area under Israeli military control. It's hard for me to see that happening. The court may, however, choose to recommend that these organizations refile their case using existing Israeli privacy laws, or they may turn them down.
So these new rules, Noga, they also apply to Palestinians in the West Bank, but you said it's mainly focused on Gaza.
Right, because the area where the need for aid is the most extreme, and therefore where most of the work of these organizations takes place right now, is in Gaza. This is the Israeli government trying to reinforce its point, which they have not succeeded in establishing. And that's the accusation that many of these organizations are not much more than fronts for terror organizations. The state of Israel seems to be pushing out organizations, you know, by forcing them to turn over data that they claim would put the lives of their employees in danger, basically forcing out organizations that for now, at the stage that we're at in the Trump peace plan, there's no one on site who can replace them.
What would be the impact on civilians in Gaza if these aid workers are kicked out?
The impact would be significant. And I do want to especially underscore the importance of Doctors Without Borders, who run a significant number of clinics, their own clinics and clinics within hospitals, and who supply medication that nobody else brings into Gaza. So what has gotten into Gaza basically is under the aegis of these organizations in terms of medicine, in terms of supplies like diapers, T-shirts, really basic necessities that Gazans didn't have access to for more than 2 years.
I'm speaking with journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem about new rules requiring aid groups in Gaza to hand over personal data to Israeli officials. So this would impact the staff of these organizations, but explain how local Palestinian staff are impacted compared to international workers.
Mostly what we're talking about is organizations, including some UN agencies, drawing a line and saying to Israel, we can't turn over to you all of this private data. For example, an entire family tree of an employee, their educational history and social media history going back 15 years. we are not going to turn all of this over to you because it would put our employees in danger. That's what they're saying. And Israel is saying, well, if you don't give it to us, you can leave. There's one very notable absent voice here, which is that of the United States. The United States is basically governing Gaza right now militarily, and we haven't heard from the United States, which leads me to suspect that some of the American army officers who are running things here on the ground from the headquarters down in southern Israel may think that if these organizations leave, it will open a path for the Board of Peace, Trump's Board of Peace, to begin acting. It would maybe force Israel to let the members of the Palestinian technocratic administrative board come into Gaza. But what I foresee, if this law is upheld and the organizations do choose to leave, I think that we're going to quickly be plunged into a renewed humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Just explain what you mean that the U.S. is running things militarily in Gaza. Are there actual U.S. boots on the ground there, or are they more in a supervisory training role with those Indonesian troops?
We're not granted access to the U.S. headquarters in Kiryat Gat in southern Israel. I can tell you what I know, but not what I have seen. There are no U.S. troops on the ground inside Gaza. But what we have is a U.S. military headquarters in southern Israel that basically okays every single Israeli action within the zone that Israel still controls, which is more or less half of the territory of Gaza, and also Israeli military actions within the zone still controlled by Hamas. In addition, the United States is okaying or not okaying Israeli decisions regarding what aid is going into Gaza or not. Basically, there's now a kind of an overlord watching over Israel's actions as it relates to Gaza, and that's the United States.
Israeli officials, Noga, say this policy is about preventing aid money from reaching militant groups like Hamas. What evidence have they presented to support that claim?
The Israeli authorities have presented very scant evidence, if at all, and they've really not proven their points. There were some cases during the war in which Israel was able to indicate, not prove, but indicate that there were aid workers in Lebanon who in fact were Hezbollah operatives. There have over the years been cases in which, for example, UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, were caught employing teachers who were affiliated to Hamas. But this is not a mass phenomenon when you consider the thousands and thousands and thousands of Palestinians who are employees of these organizations. I want to point out an ironic other side to this. The government of Israel, under Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, transferred more than $1 billion of Qatari funds into Gaza in the 5 years leading up to October 7th. He thought that by transferring money into Gaza in this way, Israel was, and I'm quoting now, buying quiet. The doctrine obviously failed, but the Israeli government is doing many, many things to try and erase the fact that it itself transferred money to this terror group for years and years. That's part of what we are seeing here. We're also seeing in part an Israeli response to what I think I can call an unfortunate decision over the years by most of these humanitarian groups not to be absolutely candid when they reported back to donor nations or to their donors about Hamas's activities in Gaza. A certain part of Israel's rancor towards these organizations stems from the fact that over the years, when Israel would argue that it had to act in Gaza because Hamas was building a network of terror tunnels underground, these organizations, including some that worked in hospitals or in schools, would say, we've never heard of that. Our local employees haven't heard of that. When you talk to them today, they justify it by saying, look, wherever we are, we have to work with the local authorities. It can be Putin, it can be Hamas, it can be whoever. But I think that that policy by these humanitarian groups should also be questioned. And certainly it has given Israel a little bit of a justification in its accusations against them today.
So that policy could be questioned, but let's be blunt. Did these aid groups have any choice about operating in Gaza without their work essentially being supervised by Hamas?
I think they could have been more candid, and Israel might then have felt less isolated when it claimed that Hamas was doing these things in Gaza.
Noga, give us a reality check. How much humanitarian aid and medical personnel are making their way into Gaza at the moment?
Since the ceasefire has been put into place, we actually have less information about how much aid is actually getting into Gaza because, again, the United States is now supervising this, and for some reason, the Israeli authorities feel less of a necessity to give us, you know, for example, daily reports of how many trucks are going in. The situation in Gaza is one in which, for example, Chef Jose Andres's World Central Kitchen is organizing and coordinating much of the distribution of food for thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who still need it. But again, if they're not able to continue work there, to my knowledge, at this moment, there's simply no alternative in place.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky joined us from Jerusalem.
Russian strikes on Ukraine's power grid have led to frequent blackouts this winter. For many Ukrainians, daily life now depends on backup batteries and diesel generators. In some cities, life is mostly underground, in bomb shelters. Emily Cohen has been in touch with one woman in northern Ukraine who now takes the hardships of war in stride.
Hello?
Sorry, my power. I have turned on the charging system.
4 years into the war, even this conversation depends on backup batteries.
Every 4 hours off, and only 2 hours it's on.
Routines are built around when the power is on. Over the past year, we've talked weekly about everything from books to the war. We met through Engine, a volunteer program pairing English speakers with Ukrainians practicing the language.
I always try to prepare a good time when I have electricity. And we will help communicate. I always try to make together these two schedules and arrange our call.
Skrevets lives about 150 kilometers east of Kyiv. She follows telegram channels for both where she lives in Priluki and where her mother is, further east in Konotop. For Skrevets, the habit is less about distraction than it is about survival.
And first of all, I check during night Konotop was bombed or no. And after I call my mother and ask how she is going and how she spends this night. Of course, I feel anxiety and like anxiety. I can't describe these emotions. It's you concentrated only on this. In my mother's home, it was near 24 hours without power. And when she came back home from her friend, it was 8 degrees in the home.
That's 8 degrees Celsius, about 46 degrees Fahrenheit. Skrebets's mom got innovative. She called a relative and they connected the car battery to the heating system. Their ingenuity warmed the house about 10 degrees. Still not warm, but manageable.
This winter, we are more like adaptable for this. Before, it was first year, and we don't have any flashlight. We don't have any battery. It was harder than now, as for my opinion. Now we are more prepared. I use camp stove because at my apartment where I rent, there is induction stove, and I can't use it. It's something new, but I have found two videos in YouTube. And I have watched videos and I have taught how to use this device. And my mother, she has a gas stove. She cooks without problem.
As challenging as it is, Skrevets counts herself lucky. She's got a good job as a manager at a factory and she has a nice apartment. She's doing pretty well for herself, all things considered. And she has a backup power source that charges when the electricity is on.
My charging station I have got from my work because our managers, they decided to buy for every employee. First time I have started to use it. I like feel freedom because you don't depend from electricity, from power. Simple things bring happy to you. Simple things like you can take shower. Simple things like you can drink tea. Like you can dry your hair. This is like your life. You always think about simple things before you never think about this.
Scrabbit says there's cacophony when you walk outside. The sound of generators fills the streets.
Everywhere is hum, everywhere is noisy. You can't communicate with, for example, if you go with somebody or if you want to call for somebody. It's impossible because always hum and like a tractor. People joke like this is the sound of Ukraine. When you go out, it's always everywhere. And we get used to live like this. I try to sometime to forget. I try to make maybe half an hour to forget. I try to read the book. I always check my phone. It looks like I am crazy and I can't live without my phone. It's not normal because it was not my habit before. And now I wake up and I always take phone in my hands.
She's not just reading the news or scrolling through social media. She's checking an app that alerts her to the threat of incoming missiles and drones. But she doesn't go to the shelter because she's gotten used to it. And she says that life must go on. Otherwise, all her time will be wasted underground.
Увага! Повітряна тривога! Увага! Високий рівень небезпеки! Пройдіть в найближче укриття!
A lot of people, they say how winter cold, how they wait for spring. As for me, better cold winter and be without power than bombed.
Scrabbits has stayed these 4 years because her mother refuses to leave. But for the first time in the year that we've been speaking, Scrabbits says she's open to moving somewhere. But she wonders where that would be and what kind of job she could get. Most Ukrainian refugees have a hard time finding work and end up doing menial jobs just to get by. And Scrabbits says scrubbing toilets isn't her thing. For The World, I'm Emily Cohen.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Visitors to the Venice Biennale Art Exhibition in 2024 got an eyeful as they entered the venue. Building-sized paintings of parrots, crocodiles, and fish in reds, purples, green, yellow, blue, basically the whole rainbow. That was the international art world's real introduction to the work of indigenous artists from the Brazilian Amazon who founded an artistic movement they call Macu. Gisele Regatão went to the heart of this movement in Brazil to see how the locals are changing art while using their creations to fight for cultural survival.
We're in the winter season in the Amazon, which means it's still hot and it rains a lot. It's pouring when I get to the home of Acelino Rony Cunha, one of the original members of Macu. Macu stands for Movement of the Artists Rony Cunha. The Rony Cunha are indigenous people from this area of Brazil. We are in Jordão, a town with less than 10,000 people in the state of Acre, accessible only by boat or small plane. Marcelino goes back and forth between Jordão and their village, Chico Curumim, which is 3 hours away by fast boat. Marcelino bought this house with money from his art. That has been one of the goals of Macu, to sell art to buy real estate. All the Macu drawings and paintings are representations of traditional songs. In this case, it's this one. This canvas means we're calling for strength, he says. The painting is filled with fish, birds, and indigenous people in bright colors, like yellow and pink. A snake forms three long waves in the middle. Macu has 8 members today, most from the same family. Acelino's uncle, Iban Salles Rony Cunha, is the founder of the group.
O meu pai é contador de história, é música,
My father was a storyteller and musician, and I fell in love with our songs. I'm still enchanted with them today, he says. To create the paintings, Maku members drink ayahuasca, an infusion prepared with plants from the Amazon. It has hallucinogenic properties, and the Huniquim people also use it for rituals and healing. We don't have writing, just memory, Iba says. Iba is 62 years old. He started compiling the songs of the Huniquim people in the 1980s.
O Iban estava muito preocupado com a perda da língua.
Cássia Borges, Iban's wife, says her husband thought that with the songs he would recover the indigenous language, and he has succeeded, she says. Iban's songs and drawings first grabbed international attention thanks to his work with anthropologist Hamilton de Matos. Matos is a professor at the Federal University of Acre. He met Iban in a training program for indigenous educators in the late 2000s, and he started filming him. They were little videos. Iban would sing and explain the song, showing his drawings, he says. Matos ended up organizing a drawing workshop and then an exhibition with those illustrations in 2011. That was their first show. Matos posted images of the exhibit on his blog, and it got the attention of the Cartier Foundation, a contemporary art museum in Paris. They came to Jourdain and bought around 15 drawings for less than 4,000 euros, Matos says. Today, each of Maku's paintings sell for between $10,000
and $30,000.
As you can imagine, it was a revolution in our lives, Matos says. The drawings were shown in Paris, and after that, Iban, Acelino, and others formalized Maku as a group. That was in 2013.
I thought it was like absolutely superb. I loved it.
Mark Bautier is an independent art curator who works in Brazil. In 2014, he commissioned the group to paint the walls of an old hospital in the city of São Paulo. That was their first mural.
They made along the wall huge snakes walking through the old room.
He says despite Maku's success, indigenous culture is still undervalued in Brazil. Today, less than 1% of Brazil's population is indigenous. Since 1996, they have lived on set-aside land, which is owned by the federal government.
They don't realize how important it is to preserve such a culture and to preserve people who are taking care of the nature.
Potier says the art world can also bring a lot of pressure for native people, as they are exposed to greedy collectors and an opaque market.
It's very frightening because you enter the worst of the civilization. It's something you feel like you're trapped. It's another sort of prison.
Around 70 of Maku's pieces are here at the Museum of Art of São Paulo. Guilherme Jufrida is a curator at the museum. He says at first glance, people might see Maku's work as simple. They draw and paint colorful figures. But he explains the paintings are just an entry point.
Tipo a ponta do iceberg, vamos dizer assim, mas tem todo o iceberg para você desvendar e aí você
It's like
vai,
the tip of the iceberg, but there's a whole iceberg for you to discover. And then you'll dive into a philosophical, mythical, and fascinating universe, he says. Despite Maku's success inside museums in Brazil and abroad, they are not very well known in their own state. On my last day in Jourdain, I spoke to Iban's two daughters who have joined Maku in the past few years. Rita Runicoin is an artist and also a leader for indigenous women. My voice is not only to speak about my culture, but it's a form of protest because we, indigenous people, are seen as invisible, she says. Her younger sister, Yaka Runicoin, also sees their work as advocacy. We want our work to get as far as possible, to bring respect for indigenous people, so that we can protect our native land with our art, she says. Their daddy, Iban, shares the sentiment. He's currently looking for a bigger gallery that can represent them abroad. Lately, we're not selling a lot of work. Our canvases are gathering dust and our members need the money, he says. In November, Maku will paint a mural at a museum in Denver. It will be their first in the U.S. Iban says he hopes international collectors will understand that what they do is not just art. It's much more than that. For The World, I'm Gisele Regatao, Jordão, Acre, Brazil.
You can see Gisele's pictures of the Maku artists along with their vibrant work on our website. That's theworld.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.